Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Yohai Benkler, who is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and faculty co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. And he is the co-author of the new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yohai Benkler.
Glad to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us. And today, at a very combative press conference, President Trump was very angry and insulting towards one particular member of the media from CNN. But in general, his tone was quite hostile. He was asked a question about what he should do about social media in terms of policing content. And he cited the First Amendment and said he was a huge believer in the First Amendment and thought that that probably meant he wouldn't do anything or at least approach it cautiously. But my sense about these new platforms and their enormous importance and influence, like Facebook, for example, isn't the problem the platforms themselves?
So I think our research actually pushes back to some extent. Not that there's nothing wrong with the platforms, is what we find, but that at least when you're looking at American politics, television is much more important. Talk radio is not less important. And a lot of the most destructive disinformation is not the result of platform algorithms, but the result of a sustained campaign on one side. And on the other, long-term competitive dynamics in the right-wing media ecosystem that practically force anybody operating in that market to just ramp it up to the sharpest, most extreme versions of self-reinforcing stories. So it's just a lot less about, at least if you look at the United States, it's a lot less about the platforms, and a lot more about the political culture and the media ecosystem on the right.
And there is, as you point out in your new book, a kind of asymmetry here, is there not? That on the right, even though liberals and conservatives are arguably both in separate bubbles, and there is no consensus in this country anymore about what is true and what is real. If you, for example, go back to the days of Walter Cronkite there, on the evening news, Uncle Walter seemed to be believed by most Americans. Now, those days are over. But there is a tendency, and I've fallen into that tendency myself, to equate Fox and MSNBC by saying, well, conservatives get their information from Fox and liberals from MSNBC. But at least on MSNBC, they do practice journalism. And I think it's important that you have pointed that out.
So our observations really come out of the data. We analyzed millions, I mean literally 4 million political stories from 2015 to 2018. And we analyzed the data on multiple dimensions. We looked at what online news sites link to, so how media producers link to each other, which the platforms have nothing to do with. We looked at Twitter. We looked at Facebook. We used text itself and the similarity of text. Again and again, what comes back when we use different platforms, when we use different measures, and when we use different techniques, what always comes back is that you have a stark and insular right-wing media ecosystem anchored in Fox and in Breitbart, where the entire dynamic is to reinforce the set of partisan beliefs, police anyone, whether it's a politician or a media outlet, that steps out of line, and compete between the major sites having the least extreme versions, and then sites competing and differentiating themselves on just how extreme the rhetoric they can throw is. There is no such thing on the left. Essentially, if you go all the way from the, let's call it center-right Wall Street Journal or Forbes, all the way to the left, It's not that you don't see partisan outlets. You absolutely see partisan outlets. But they're all part of a single media ecosystem. And we see when we look at audiences based on Twitter, based on Facebook, the audience also spreads its attention much more broadly. People seem to be looking at a more diverse range of outlets, some in the center, some in the center left, some in the left. And this structure, both of audience behavior and of outlet behavior, forces everyone to be more measured, to be more anchored in reality. There's real competition between the outlets to criticize each other if they get it wrong. There's real competition to come out first with the story, but also to come out first with the debunking. And that dynamic in the much more diverse and ideologically broader media ecosystem on the left means that it operates much more anchored in reality and less stoking of extremism. There is some extremism in very specific outlets. It's not that you don't see disinformation and very sharpened views. But overall, when you look at the population, these sites play a much more peripheral role, whereas on the right, they really are the center of the media ecosystem.
And again, I'm speaking with Yochai Benkler, who is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and faculty co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He's the co-author of the new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. And your new book refutes, to some extent, the conventional wisdom about how much Russian manipulation in the 2016 elections was effective. It's not to say it didn't happen, but its effects have been exaggerated. And you also suggest that the micro-targeting by Cambridge Analytica, its effect has also been exaggerated. But that's not to say that in effect, Fox News and Trump himself are examples of the success of what Vladislav Surkov brought to the table in Russia. The new term, of course, for people like Vladislav Surkov, a former theater director, is a political technologist. And he taught Putin how to manipulate reality and turn politics into theater. And we have a reality TV star in the Oval Office, and he and Fox News certainly do that. I mean, you saw Hannity on stage with him just the other night. The loop is complete, shall we say, with Bill Shine, the protege of Roger Ailes, who started Fox News, now as the White House communications director.
Absolutely. Every piece of that, in my view, is right. In other words, absolutely, when we looked for Russians, we found them. They're there. They're trying. And for people who are concerned with the legitimacy of the election, there's no question that for a foreign power like this to intervene in American politics in the way that they did is illegal. And for someone to collaborate with them, actually in terms of conspiring to perform illegal acts like hacking, is also illegal. Not that the U.S. did not intervene and doesn't intervene in other countries clandestinely, but let's put that aside. The point is not whether they were trying or whether what they did was illegal, but did it have an impact? And when we actually dig in deeply into the concrete allegations of how the Russians influenced the election, and we study all of the email, all of the stories about the emails, and the specific crazy conspiracy theories that came out of one or the other, consistently we see the Russians essentially jumping on the bandwagon of things that were already pushed on the right, leaning into themes that were already there, and in many senses being relatively peripheral. So if you spend a few $100,000 doing targeted advertising to suppress the vote, and you know that the Trump campaign itself spent millions doing the same thing, it's very hard to suddenly say that was exactly the incremental additional piece. And the same is true with regard to Cambridge Analytica, which seemed to be more hype from the company itself. But the core point you're making, which is that the strategy that emerges in the middle of the first decade of the 20th century in Russia, but really ramps up with Putin around after 2012 when he comes back, of continuously confusing everyone and making the entire project of understanding what's going on in the world being more a piece of entertainment, and essentially everyone doubts everything and nothing is true. That's a remarkably effective tool for authoritarians, because if everything is true or everything is untrue, then the authoritarian leader can essentially get away with everything. And this is absolutely central to the strategy we see now with Trump, rolling out one outrage after another, things that are completely impossible, like we'll give a tax break while Congress is not in session. One flows after the other. The caravan is showing up. Some of them are specifically tailored to incite. Others are just confusing. That state of affairs, where you have a whole population that simply doesn't know where to look in order to find what's true and not, makes it much easier for an authoritarian figure like Trump to get away with anything, because everything is possible, nothing is true, you do whatever you want, and no one can hold you to account because no one knows what's going on. Enormously dangerous.
So then that leads me to the question about who is enabling this, and that has to be Rupert Murdoch. And you have to ask yourself, what is going on here? Apparently Murdoch is very much a mentor of Trump, talks to him regularly, if not every day, on the phone, and then he hangs up the phone and says, "What a bloody idiot," you know. And then he's also the literally the matchmaker who put Ivanka and Jared Kushner together. So obviously, there's a connection there, but why is Murdoch doing this, do you think? Is it power? What explains that cynicism?
So I'd rather not speculate, because this isn't something I know from my research, and I really avoid doing that. I don't know what drives Murdoch. It's obviously a fantastic business model, and it's been an enormous success for Fox News. It may well be primarily a political ploy, but I think it's important not to focus, at least for me, not to focus on the individual agency, this terrible evil genius or that terrible evil character, but rather to look at the structure of the problem, which is to say, before Murdoch, there was already Limbaugh. Alongside Fox, there's already Clear Channel buying up hundreds of radio stations, buying Premier Radio, the producer of all of the major talk radio shows, and programming coast to coast, 24 hours a day, bile and hatred from Limbaugh, from Glenn Beck, from Sean Hannity as well. So you're getting, these are not Murdoch, but they're doing the same thing. Breitbart, this is again Mercer-funded, Bannon-led, also not Murdoch. What's important in this regard to understand is that the structure of the network, the way in which these actors have learned how to make a lot of money from using the fact that the Republican Party drew in as part of its base both strong white identity voters and strong religious voters, each of which for its own purposes is disconnected from, let's call it, mainstream professional judgments of how you get things right and wrong, and then uses this market segmentation to make big business out of telling people what they want to hear and giving them their daily shot of bile, anger, outrage, the sense of shared identity from hating someone else. It's that big business of selling outrage, selling hatred, selling affirmation and membership to this audience that's much more important to my mind than any single individual who is a large player in this market.
Well, in terms of the audiences for the liberal and conservative media, it's pretty clear that liberals want facts and conservatives want their biases reinforced, and that's certainly what Limbaugh and company do. And to my mind, you know, there's not a great deal of difference between the profession of journalism and being an intelligence officer, in the sense that you're supposed to be skeptical, you're supposed to be inquiring, you're not supposed to be gullible, you're not supposed to believe propaganda and the first thing that people in power tell you. That is the antithesis. And that, frankly, I think is a more traditional or useful definition of what liberal means, to be skeptical as opposed to be gullible. But how do you operate in an environment where to Donald Trump, the truth is irrelevant, but to journalism, the truth is everything? So you've got the president saying the press is the enemy of the people, when it's very much more likely that the truth is the enemy of Donald Trump.
Well, I think that the core diagnosis of the press is the enemy of the people only if the truth is the enemy of Donald Trump gets it just right. When you ask what do you do, I think as long as it appears to be the case, and this might change over time, but as long as it appears to be the case that there's a good 15 to 25% of the population who do vote Republican, who do lean Republican, who do sometimes watch Fox News, but are not 100% in that echo chamber, they do also watch a lot of local news. They do also watch a lot of network news. They watch some CNN. It's less reading newspapers, actually, and the relatively older audiences, so not so much online. That audience becomes really important to educate and to help remember this ideal of a moment of Walter Cronkite, as you describe it, even though when we look at it in hindsight, we understand that that was a deeply problematic dynamic, excluding views not only on the right but also on the left, having a very patriarchal view often, excluding views of minorities. It's not as though we actually believe that in the myth of the Walter Cronkite era anymore for anyone. It's complicated. But continuing to insist on the importance, not falling for really now everything is just a bias confirmation, so we have to move for that. Being very explicit to audiences about what's going on and not falling for traps. One of the classic, there's tremendous media activism, if you want to think of it in this way, going on, both from Trump and from right-wing media, that makes it very hard for mainstream media to just leave things alone. So in the campaign, it was the Clinton emails and the Clinton Foundation. This last midterm, it was the caravan. It was the sudden decision that he can get rid of birthright citizenship. Each of these, essentially, you throw a flame into the fire, and it's very hard for traditional journalists to contain themselves and not cover, because it's so outrageous. It draws audiences. Mm-hmm. And so it will require a lot of self-discipline from editors and journalists about how to curate, what to cover, how not to cover, how little to cover something that's unimportant, even if the president is talking about it a lot. That's not easy, and that's a completely different way of thinking about journalism when you're in the presence of such highly asymmetric and cynical propagandism than it was when everybody was more or less in the same universe of what it meant to have facts, not to have facts, to try to investigate them, not to investigate them. So I think that's the big challenge of journalism today. It's far from solved, but I think as soon as journalists and editors recognize that this is the great challenge in the teeth of propaganda, they can at least start to be more thoughtful, more conscious, and more constructive.
Well, Yehoi Bankler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. I'm very grateful for this conversation. And again, I've been speaking with Yohai Benkler, who is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies at Harvard Law School and faculty co-director of the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He's the co-author of the new book, Network Propaganda, Manipulation, Disinformation, and Radicalization in American Politics. We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into the election results in both the House and Senate in the context of the structural disadvantages Democrats have going into the future.